Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so glad to be here with you all today, and I'm very appreciative of this invitation to speak. I'm here today on behalf of the Tennessee Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, and I'm joined by my friend and my colleague, Beth Foster, who's one of the chairs of this campaign in Tennessee. First, I want to offer some words of introduction beyond just what was shared there. I come to you today as your geographic and your ecumenical neighbor. I live here in Murfreesboro, and I serve as clergy at St. Mark's United Methodist Church, which is just up the road on Rutherford Boulevard. I'm an ordained minister in the United Methodist Church. I'm originally from Indiana, but I've been living and serving here in Tennessee for over 2 years now. In the United Methodist Church, we have two orders of ordained clergy. They are considered equal but distinct orders of clergy, and it's designed to reflect the distinct calls that we live into. I am ordained into the order of deacon, which is the smaller of the two orders in the UMC. We are clergy who are ordained to word, service, compassion, and justice. As an ordained deacon, I am particularly charged to interpret and bear witness to the hurts and the hopes of the world. As some people say, the charge of the deacon is to offer a deacon's eyed view of the church and of the world. And so in that spirit, I want to offer to you today a testimony to the hurts and the hopes of the world, and in particular of our community right here in Murfreesboro. So friends, let's talk about poverty for a moment. In this country, there are 140 million people, that's 43.5% of the population, who are poor or low income. And it's not because of a poor work ethic. It's because of the political forces in this country that have consistently blocked living wages, healthcare for all, and union rights. Over 50 years ago in this country, we declared a war on poverty. But my friends, the reality is we're in the midst of a war on the poor. The richest 1% of our country have more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. Tennessee has the highest percentage of minimum wage workers in the country. And a law that was passed 5 years ago that prohibits cities from raising the minimum wage above the federal baseline, all the while refusing to expand Medicaid and even passing laws to further punish and demonize the uninsured. These poverty statistics hold up right here in Murfreesboro, where more than 57,000 of our neighbors are poor or low income, and over 16,000 of our neighbors here in Murfreesboro are without health insurance. We live in a community where it is all too easy to eat in restaurants and shop in stores while ignoring the plight of those who are serving us. We live in the buckle of the Bible Belt, but we seem to have forgotten Scripture's call to care for the poor, the sick, women and children, and immigrants. My friends, today I'm here to tell you that our neighbors are hurting. In this country, there are 3 million people who are living in shelters, transitional housing centers, and tent cities. Right here in Rutherford County, at the end of the last school year, there were 1,500 children in the city and county school systems who were identified as homeless. 1,500. And we know that statistically, 60% of all homeless children are under the age of 5, so they're not even in school. We have over 10,000 households in this community that make less than $25,000 a year. And at that level of income, affordable housing would be around $500 a month or less. So for those 10,000 households, in 2015, we only had 2,500 units at that rate. and most of those are too small for families. And since 2015, median rent has increased $247 a month here in Murfreesboro. In addition, we only have 4 rooms available in emergency shelters for families. 4 rooms, not buildings. Nearly every week in my job at the church, I hear heartbreaking stories from people in this community who are without housing. Most recently, it was from a young woman who was sharing a meal with me at the church, and she spends her days working 2 jobs. Both are minimum wage, both are part-time with no guaranteed hours or benefits. She walks to them because she doesn't have a car, so she walks to those 2 jobs, and everywhere she goes, or she might be able to catch a ride on the Rover. And recently, she lost her housing when her landlord unexpectedly decided to stop renting out the spare room in their house. And so she told me, when we were sharing this meal, that she had in the past volunteered to help with homeless ministries here in Murfreesboro, but she never thought that she herself would be the one without a home. But it happened overnight, and despite the fact that she works harder than most of us do, she still can't earn enough to live on or find an affordable place to live in Murfreesboro. So she sleeps every night on a spare old mattress in churches or other hospitable locations in town before she gets up and starts her long day of walking and working again. My friends, our neighbors are hurting. In this country, we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. Nearly 5 times that of other wealthy countries, with nearly 1.5 million people incarcerated, 2/3 of which are people of color. Women are the fastest growing segment of incarcerated people in the United States. Most of those are Black or Latinx, and more than 80% of them are imprisoned for nonviolent offenses. The growth in incarceration coincides with an increase in federal spending on prisons to $7.5 billion a year and a broader criminalization of the poor. By the Department of Justice's own admission, think about this for a moment, by the Department of Justice's own admission, 95% of the growth in incarceration since the year 2000 is a result of an increase in the number of unconvicted defendants. Those are pre-trial defendants, many of whom are unable to make bail. Right here in the state of Tennessee, 1 in 10 children currently have or have had a parent who is incarcerated. My friends, our neighbors are hurting. We know that poverty does not occur in a vacuum, but is inexorably linked to systemic racism, to militarism, ecological devastation. And in this country, systemic racism is alive and well, and is especially visible in racialized voter suppression efforts that have continued in the post-civil rights era and have seen a dramatic rise in the past decade. There are fewer voting rights today than there were 50 years ago. There are fewer voting rights today than there were 50 years ago, thanks to racist gerrymandering and redistricting laws, restrictive voter ID laws, reduced access to early voting and even polling locations where people can go on election day, and increased felony convictions. Because we know that 1 in 13 Black adults will have a felony conviction. Recently, a friend of mine at the church I serve was sharing with me her struggles to help her 90-something-year-old father register to vote after he moved to town to live with her. But because he had no Tennessee state ID as a new resident, because he didn't drive or travel internationally and have a passport, because he was born in a time in a community where births happened at home, and therefore he couldn't produce a certified birth certificate, And because he had no utilities in his name, because he lived with his daughter who was taking care of him. For the first time in about 70 years or so of voting religiously, he was unable to vote when he moved to Tennessee. So despite living full-time in the city, being active in the church and the community, as he ages with the support of his family, he is denied a say in what the government of his new home looks like. Friends, these unjust laws hurt not only the people who are denied their votes, but also those whose lives are upended by the politicians who are put in office by the violent extremism that is voter suppression. The prevalence of racism in this country is visible not only in those laws and systems, but also in the rise of neo-Nazi groups here and across the country. Just 7 months ago, in October of last year, this community was challenged to face that reality when white supremacists chose Murfreesboro as the site of their White Lives Matter rally. And friends, let us be clear, it was no accident that they chose our community. We live in a state that is ranked number 2 in the nation for the number of hate groups that call this their home. We live in a community that has a history of anti-immigrant sentiment and Islamophobia. We live where the landscape is literally riddled with seemingly immovable Confederate statues and monuments, two of which are right here in Murfreesboro. Monuments that are erected not to remember loved ones who died in war, but to reinforce the reign of white supremacy in a Jim Crow era. My friends, our neighbors, here and across the state and across the nation are hurting. My faith tradition and every major religious tradition understands that at its core, morality is about standing with the vulnerable and the marginalized. It's about challenging oppression and criticizing systems of injustice. We understand that the most sacred moral principles are rooted in valuing the lives of all people. But for far too long, in the name of people of faith, like you and like me, religious extremists have perpetuated a moral narrative in this country that blames poor people for being poor and spreads the lie of scarcity. The idea that somehow in this wealthiest of countries, there is not enough to go around. And friends, this is not just an issue of philosophical disagreement. We're talking about matters of life and death. Because every year, more than 250,000 people die in the United States from poverty and poverty-related issues. And that is immoral. I told you at the beginning that my charge in the United Methodist Church is to bear witness and interpret the hurts and the hopes of the world. And there's a lot of hurt. But there is still hope. There's hope in people of faith and people of conscience who rise up to demand a moral revival in this country. There's hope when people like you and like me, we'll join together to break the silence and put our very bodies on the line to say that we withdraw consent to these systems and these policies that are harming and even killing our friends, our families, and our neighbors. There's hope when we live into the scriptures fully and we proclaim good news to the poor, release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, and freedom for the oppressed. My friends, I stand before you today because I find hope in the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. And I hope you will too.
Good morning, friends. I come to you this morning with good news. And that good news is that a new and unsettling force, a nonviolent army, if you will, is rising up to confront evil in this country. That evil has names. Those names are systemic racism, poverty, the war economy, and ecological devastation. And they are fed and nurtured and growing because of the distorted moral narrative that bombards us with fake news and hate and warmongering in a seemingly endless barrage of tweets and posts and sound bites. Breaking through that distorted moral narrative is the first mission of this nonviolent army, that new and unsettling force. And that force is rising. It is rising from among those who suffer most, among people of faith, among activists and advocates, panhandlers and doctors, fast food workers and lawyers. It is rising in states across the country and in DC, and it is rising in Tennessee. By the time this weekend ends, we will have trained more than 200 people in Tennessee to take part in nonviolent fusion moral direct action as we launch 40 days of action that will happen simultaneously in 30 state capitals and the District of Columbia. And it will also happen in Tennessee. It will happen in Legislative Plaza in Nashville beginning at 2 p.m. 1 week from tomorrow. The Poor People's Campaign is both universal and deeply personal. Most of those involved can tell you about the personal reasons they are committed to joining with others across the lines that usually divide us. The lines of race, religion, sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, geography, and so much more. As the co-director of Mercy Junction Justice and Peace Center, a project of the Mercy Junction Interfaith Congregation that is committed to justice and peacemaking and equality and hospitality, it is my job and my calling to work for justice, but it is also deeply personal. What I remember about Christmas Eve as a little girl growing up is how desperately hard the adults tried to make it festive and to ensure it was magical and beautiful, and we got so much more than what we needed. But what I also remember is how deeply sad my grandmother and my dad were beneath that fiend festiveness. My grandfather, my dad's dad, had been a migrant fruit picker. And in the wintertime, he picked up whatever kind of work he could find. That often meant long and brutal hours in extreme weather exposed to the elements. He died at the age of 32 on Christmas Eve. My grandmother says his death was directly related to poverty and the conditions to which he exposed his body as he worked so hard to provide for his family in a system that didn't make that possible. My grandmother would always begin her stories by saying the Fosters were just so, so, so poor. The trauma of poverty, of what it takes away, of what it costs, of what it does, is really the essence of what I remember about those Christmases. And I knew as a little girl, and I know now, that this is so wrong. In a world where there is more than enough for everybody, it is wrong that a few are allowed to hoard what others are dying from lack of. Through luck and some hard work, but let's be honest, we all know that hard work won't save us in this system unless we have some good connections and some luck. I was spared the direct trauma of poverty and grew up in a financially solid working class family. My grandmother and parents were farmers who owned their own land by the time I came along. I was able to go to college and settled into a relatively good job after graduation, complete with a pension, 401k, and health insurance. But all of that ended when the company for which I worked was sold. As a freelancer, I was doing okay until I got ill and required expensive medical care with no health insurance. And then, like so many of my brothers and sisters and siblings across the country, I found myself facing foreclosure, bankruptcy, and the inability to access medical care. When I talked to my dad about the Poor People's Campaign, he said, waving his hand out the window toward his farm, "But we're not poor." But the reality is, friends, that most of us in this country are poor, and my dad is still poor. Unless you're in that 1%, you're likely just one layoff, one illness, one car wreck, one admission to the nursing home, to finding yourself traveling down a road toward destitution. The reality is that this country was built to work this way. It was built on the oppression of people of color and working class people and poor people to enrich the elite. Reverend Barber, who is one of the national co-chairs of this campaign, says, "We're not trying to make America great again. We're trying to make America something she's never been before." In the same vein, Dr. King called on America to just be true to what she said she was on paper. To step into this work of the Poor People's Campaign in 2018 is to step into the work that Dr. King was doing when he was murdered 50 years ago. This is not a new campaign. This is not a commemoration of that work. This is the continuation of that original Poor People's Campaign. The truth is that we've not come very far in 50 years. The truth is we've taken many steps back. We currently live in a state where the legislature could not even give hearing to a resolution to denounce white supremacy and Nazis. White supremacy and the systemic racism it spawns brutalizes our siblings of color. But the truth is that it also hurts white people. There are more white people who are homeless, more white people without health insurance, than there are people of color. And white supremacy helps keep us all who are struggling divided so that we can't fight back. The truth is that the war economy hurts us all, but we know it hurts the vulnerable more. A veteran who spoke at a recent Poor People's Campaign training I attended explained that we don't really have a voluntary military in the United States. The reality is that poor people are forced into the military as one of the only options available to them. At that point, their bodies being used to enrich those who profit off war. The truth is environmental degradation will eventually hurt all of us. But the reality is that the poorest among us are the first to breathe the toxic air, drink the poisoned water, and deal with the wreckages of climate change. This campaign is for all of us, because all of us will in some way be traumatized by the effects of these sins. This campaign is for all of us, about all of us, and needs all of us. We need you to join in this new and unsettling force, this nonviolent army rising up for the liberation of all people. You can text the word moral to 90975 or visit poorpeoplescampaign.org to register with the campaign. What is coming is unlike anything this country has ever seen. The Poor People's Campaign promises to make history. While our nation's bedrock is in white supremacy and capitalism, we come from a heritage that reminds us that we have generations of ancestors who struggled before us toward justice. We come from a heritage that reminds us that there is a stream that flows with nonviolent resistance that changed the course of human events over and over. Our ancestors are waiting for us to join them in that stream. And there is a nonviolent army, a new and unsettling force that is getting ready to walk into those waters in our time to take our place in history. And that is the good news I come to share with you today.